Welcome to the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, where you'll get actionable tips and advice on major gifts, direct response fundraising, legacy giving, and much more from leading experts in the nonprofit sector. Now, here are your hosts of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, Andrew Olson and Roy Jones.
Hi, this is Andrew Olson and Roy Jones with Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast. Welcome today. This is our inaugural podcast episode. We are the co-authors of Rainmaking, the Fundraiser's Guide to Landing Big Gifts. Typically on these podcasts, what you'll hear is the two of us interviewing other seasoned and experienced fundraisers to bring you the best and brightest fundraising strategy that's available. Today, we've got a special opportunity to ask some questions of Roy Jones. So Roy, my partner in crime here, is Vice President of Development at Mercy Ships and has decades of experience in major gifts, direct response, all things fundraising, one of the brightest fundraisers that I know. And I'm going to take the opportunity today to pick his brain so that you all can get some great learning out of that. Good afternoon, Roy. How you doing?
Hey, good to talk to you, Andrew.
You too, brother.
It's always fun. And, you know, just I think about a lot of hours over the years working on the book together and working at the Russ Reed Agency together. And we've noodled on what's going on in the industry quite a bit. And then and now I've had the opportunity over the last 3 years to apply a lot of the lessons that we developed together in Rainmaking. And it's been a lot of fun. We have staffed, we've hired 10 major gift officers over the last 18 months as we've grown. You know, we have really, I won't say pioneered because others have done it before, but, you know, to see, first of all, a very aggressive acquisition program where we've acquired about 150,000 new donors over the last 36 months. And then for what I've been doing is coming, you know, flying right in under that and really harvesting those folks that have high net worths, reaching in. It didn't matter what their gift size is. If we saw that they had high net worth, we tried to get a person in front of them. And, you know, we have staffed up. When I got there, there were three major gift officers on the team. As I said, we've hired 10 since then. As we raise additional money, you know, our plan is to continue to put manpower resources and more FTEs, you know, into this mix. You know, it was really a hard process for a board and senior management to really get a handle on how you have to feed this fight. It is the type of thing, because it's face-to-face. You know, a major gift officer can only do 100 visits a year. The best in the business, that's as good as it gets. Yeah. And if you can only meet with 100 unique people a year, and in most cases, those that meet with 100 are in or more regional charities, so they can get in the car and go see 3 or 4 people in a day. You know, it's the type of thing that they have expectations that somehow a major gift officer could work with 300, 400, 500 different people. And it's not reality. And so, you know, once you then start to say, okay, for every 100 major donors, you're going to have a full-time major gift officer. As you build this thing out, you know, it really is what we've been, the model we've kind of put together for every, and it's one we wrote about in the book. I mean, for every additional $1 million that we've raised, we've tried to add on a new major gift officer. And that's kind of been the scale. That's how we've throttled the program up.
Well, that's pretty awesome. I mean, I've been just blown away by the successes you guys have had in the last 3 years or so. And I want to take us back to kind of the early days, if you will, when you first started at Mercy Ships. I'd love to hear, and I think it'd be valuable for our listeners to hear, when you first got on site, what did you find? What did you discover when you started to peel back the layers on the major gift operation that was in existence there? You know, what was in place that you could take advantage of, and what just had to be, you know, built from the ground up?
Well, I mean, the first thing was again, putting in place a process so we could measure activity metrics and not just count the money. They, up to that point, they had just been counting the money. You know, they had, like I said, a couple people on the team that were doing major gift work. You know, one person had all the donors east of the Mississippi.
All the donors east of the Mississippi.
Yeah, that's right. The entire
20,000 names. What is that?
And so, you know, you had, and that's you know, very, very, very normal with nonprofits thinking that, you know, just a couple people can do all the major gift work. And, you know, this is a type of thing. It's not a mass marketing program. It really is one-to-one. It really is creating communications that are one-to-one and then walking it out. And so that was the first thing, is we had to create in the database a place for each record to monitor and track the number of completed phone calls, the number of emails responded to, the number of visits, of course, the number of asks or proposals presented. They weren't really looking at those metrics. They were just putting into the database the donation that showed up. And then once I had that into the database, you know, then I created a system where I was able to eliminate all weekly reports by our major gift officers, because I could pull my own reports every day, real time. And I usually don't do it every day. I do it actually every Monday morning.
Okay.
And so we created a dashboard system where I can look at those activity metrics. We've assigned activity goals. You know, meaningful contacts are so important. And when I say meaningful contacts, I'm talking about not the outbound contact that the major gift officer sends to a donor or prospect, but when a donor engages with you, when they call you back, when they email you back, when they text you back, when they sit down and have a conversation with you. And tracking those meaningful contacts is very, very important. You know, it really is a mix. You know, we try to manage, and we try to set expectations in the donor's thinking that they understand our role. And we make this known up front that we really have a board mandate. And that was the next thing I did, is ask for this mandate, that those donors that we've identified as important enough to be assigned to a major gift officer, we want to give them an impact report every year. And that's our purpose for being there, is to be good stewards and to provide that impact report so that they know what every nickel was spent on, and that they have a good understanding that we're accountable for as good stewards of the money they give. And then the other thing that leads to designated giving. You know, I always remind our donors, I had 5 donor visits on Monday and Tuesday this week, and I said it in every conversation. You know, we can't meet with everybody. We have more than 200,000 donors, but you're one of the special folks. You're one of our top supporters. And, you know, we want to give you an impact report. And as importantly, if there's something on your heart, some specific area that you have a real interest in that you'd prefer to give to, you got to let us know that so we can help you with that designated giving. And when donors get a feel that your role there is to work for them versus working for the charity, it changes everything.
I bet. And I bet it just ups the trust factor pretty significantly, doesn't it?
And again, they know when I call them, I'm not calling to get in front of them to twist their arm to ask for money. Really is, I'm there to listen. I'm there to give them a stewardship report on what we've used their specific gift for. And most importantly, you know, every one of those meetings, every one of those conversations ends with, what do you want to do next? And people ask me, what's your presentation? That's the one I use most, because most of the time when I ask a donor that question, they have an answer. And they're so used to a lot of bad major gift officers that just show up with a PowerPoint deck and plow through it and try to make an ask. And it's really hurt the industry. And so we've done very well at getting major donors to understand what our role is. It's not to get there and work them over for a major gift. It's not that at all. You know, it really is to be a good steward, and it really is then to help them with designated giving.
Okay. So you mentioned bad major gift officers, and I wanted to ask you about this because, you know, we've had a lot of conversations about this in the past, but I want you to tell everyone about how you approached building a really high capacity major gift team at Mercy Ships. What are the kind of people you look for? What are the qualities that they need to have? How do you sniff out the fakes?
I really have worked to have a good balance. I've brought a couple people on that were strong salespeople, strong business backgrounds. I've also brought people on that have very strong nonprofit experience. But the common denominator for both is that they can shut their mouth and listen. And so often, and we think that just because somebody is a slick talker, that's the person to put in major gift work. A lot of times that's the worst person to put into major gift work. They have to be, and I'm not saying you can't be a talkative person. I guess I'm one of those folks, but when I sit down with a donor, I really flip the switch, and it really is a consultative engagement. I like to compare it to going to the doctor's office and probing for, you know, what that donor might be interested in doing. And it really is about listening. Again, I'm not saying you don't go with a few things in mind, especially if you know that donor has a heart for one area or another. But, you know, I use it to lead conversation. You know, if I go into a meeting and I've talked more than 25% of the time, I've talked too much. And that's the thing. The ones that make it in our industry are the ones that are good listeners and good at getting people to share what they're thinking. You know, it really is got to be somebody that's very good at asking questions and very good at letting that donor, I don't like that word, but we have to use it often, that person knows the reason you're there is to help them. And their only way they're really going to believe that is if you take the time to listen versus pitch. I'm not big on pitches. You know, if you're pitching, you're probably in the wrong business. Again, I'm looking for good listeners. But, you know, again, it takes someone with those sales skills that to understand that if you're going to have three visits this week in this environment, and it's very different, it is harder than it was a decade ago, because you have to integrate communications. You can't just pick up the phone and call people anymore. You'll never get a call returned. But you have to integrate handwritten notes, emails, text message, and voicemail in order to get somebody to call you back or email you back and set an appointment.
So you probably got to be pretty resilient in that role too then, right?
You have to. And again, to schedule three visits, I'm probably going to have to reach out to 20 people. 10 years ago, I would have said I only need to reach out to about 10 people. And so that it's, you know, again, you got to work harder and smarter. And, you know, I've talked to folks who have, you know, said to me, you know, I'm just not getting people to call me back. And when I ask questions and kind of bear down on the specifics, I find out, well, they only made 5 phone calls and nobody called them back. You've got to prime the pump. It takes more front end activity. So again, what am I saying? To schedule 3 visits next week or the following week, I have 20 prospects. Out of those 20 prospects, I'm going to need to email them. I'm going to need to call them. And in some cases, if I don't have an email, I'm going to have to write them. You know, you can turn around and to schedule 3 visits, it might require 40 touch points. That volume of front-end activity is staggering to some folks.
Yeah.
But in our environment, there's a lot of clutter to cut through. And again, it's once you build relationships with people, it does get easier. Once people understand your role, once people understand that why you're trying to visit with them, and once they really do have a relationship with you, you know, it does get a little easier. You know, it might not require a couple touches to schedule that thing. You might email them and they email you right back.
Looping back to something you said probably in the first 2 or 3 minutes of our conversation, you said that one of the things you did when you got to Mercy Ships was you built that dashboard report so that you could eliminate weekly reports by your gift officers. So that was your intention, if I understand it correctly, to free them up of the internal tasks to give them more time to execute those kind of touch points in order to get the meetings they need. Is that right?
That's right. And, you know, this is a very common problem in the industry. Most major gift officers spend every Friday doing one thing, working on their weekly memo, outlining all their activities. And literally, they'll waste 6 or 7 hours on a Friday trying to look good Monday through Thursday. Huh. And I mean, it's a lot of wasted effort.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some great narrative there, but most of the time it's of no real value.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying they're faking it or making it up. It's just, you know, it's a nice, pretty report. And, you know, my folks were relieved at first until they realized what it meant, that they actually then did have to spend 2 or 3 hours every Friday putting their contact activity into the database.
Okay.
And that's, you know, that's the hard part. And, you know, but, you know, I say, if it's not in the database, it didn't happen. And again, you have to make that a priority, and you got to walk that out and live that. And it's, and people have to embrace that. There's all kinds of reasons why that is so important. Obviously it's important for monitoring the metrics. You know, what gets done is what gets measured.
Yep.
But it creates a history that's very important to the charity. You know, the average major gift officer lasts less than 18 months at any particular charity. And I wish it weren't so. It's just the way it is. And some of it is deserved. Some of it not so. Sometimes charities are not patient enough. But and sometimes there are major gift officers that have spent their whole career going from charity to charity.
Well, and I want to talk about that a little bit. You and I could probably name, we won't, just to be polite, but we could probably name a half dozen or even a dozen of those that we've come across as clients in our consulting history. I had one recently, a gentleman who has drawn a six-figure salary from a charity for at least 6 years and is as a major gift officer. And to this date, can't identify an actual individual donor that he's met with, cultivated the relationship, presented a proposal, made an ask, and actually closed a gift on in 7 years. Now, I mean, think about that. I don't know if he was making six figures when he started, but, you know, that's probably somewhere around $500,000 of investment on behalf of the organization for what amounts to really just somebody filling a seat. What kind of guidance can you give for an executive director or somebody who's in a seat like yours as a VP of development overseeing major gifts to help them spot the people who are probably really savvy talkers, who know how to make people comfortable and to get their foot in the door in an organization, but are just going to suck resources out and not provide value back?
Yeah, I mean, you have to really be careful, especially those people that claim they have this secret magic black book of names of donors that are going to give to them because you hire them. It just doesn't happen that way. That's not real world. The first thing that I look for, especially when interviewing, is when I have a candidate, the job candidate, who's asking me about the database, who's asking me about the names that are currently there of current supporters that could be identified and cultivated and upgraded. You know, you really, I mean, that's going to be 80% of what a major gift officer does, is working with people that are already donors to your charity in the industry. And it is absolutely true. If you're just cold calling in the community, and we've seen some charities that when they hire a major gift officer, that's the only expectation of them. And I think it's incorrect, but all they do is cold call in the community. Well, it can take literally 3 years to get a major gift from someone that doesn't know you. And that's not an exaggeration. But if it's someone that has capacity, but is a current donor that has made multiple donations to your charity, it doesn't take 3 years. It doesn't take 2 years. It doesn't take a full year. It can take 90 days. And if you're in that database identifying, and again, wealth is important, but you know, it's recency, frequency, and dollar amount. You know, RFM, the stuff we learned in fundraising 101, you know, that's the thing that a major gift officer, a good one, focuses on: the current database, identifying those people that already have an affinity to the charity, and then cultivating them for a major gift. You know, those are the kind of folks that you really want to be looking for. Again, I'm not saying they can't do community outreach and work referrals and, you know, and do cold name prospecting. you know, my caution, my recommendation to the people that I train and work with is spend 80% of your time working with current donors. Spend only 20% of your time out in the community networking, trying to find donors in a cold environment. It's, you know, and again, what's that translate into? About 2 days a month, 20 business days a month. Don't get crazy. Don't get crazy.
I got a follow up for you. So if you're looking at a candidate and their resume shows that they've been at a different charity every 2 to 2.5 years, is that always an indicator of someone who's probably not going to turn out to be a great major gift officer, or are there instances where you would overlook that because of, you know, something else that the candidate might bring to you?
Well, as somebody who has interviewed over 70 candidates in the last 3 years, I will tell you it is, it's probably 90% of all the people in the marketplace.
Really?
And part of that is by the design of our industry. You know, I'm very concerned, in our, when I say our, I'm talking about the entire fundraising world here in the United States and the board governance that is recommendations that are given to nonprofits. You know, it usually begins with, you know, auditing, you know, throwing out your agency every 3 years, finding a new chief development officer every 36 months to 48 months. When that happens, everybody on the staff is usually run out, and the new guy brings in his own people. It's very, very prevalent, you know, that we have really encouraged, taught, trained nonprofit professionals that turnover is a good thing. And, you know, I'm concerned about it. I really think it's hurt the industry. I think a lot of folks go into an opportunity knowing that within 3 years, there's probably going to be a new chief development officer and I'll have to go find another job.
Yeah.
Just because you have a major gift officer with that kind of resume, I don't discount that at all. We've all kind of fallen into that because of the industry trend. The other side is, if I check a reference and I don't hear things like that they would be eligible to be rehired, that they'd be interested, that's where I take great pause.
Okay.
You know, some of the folks I hired, when I checked references, I just was amazed. They said, oh, so-and-so's in the market again. If you don't hire him, I'm going to. And so the good ones, you know, they are hard to come by. And, you know, a lot of times, the other side too is it's not cheap. And it is a real investment. And you're going to find that those that understand the relationship, that are good relationship builders, that are good fundraisers, that can make an ask, that can close, that can get in front of people, you know, they're very employable. They're always going to have a job. And so, again, it's you know, the types of things you're looking for are good listeners, but also folks that have good sales skills and understand how to prime the pump, the front end activity required to get in front of those people.
Yeah.
Getting in front of people is the fun part. but it's all the stuff you got to do before that to get that visit. And a lot of people just, you know, that's if they're going to fail, that's where they fail at.
Yeah.
It'll be very, I mean, I've met some great major gift officers that if I put them in front of a donor, they do amazing work and they would do well, but they don't have the, you know, the internal drive to pound out 20 calls or emails so that 17 of those people tell them no or not now. And they can't handle that rejection. You know, that it's a unique person we're hunting for. The other thing I've seen is very interesting, I think, in the last decade. 10 years ago, I think major gift officers was predominantly something that men did. And, you know, what I see today, it is predominantly people that are females. And so, you know, I encourage folks, try to, the best you can, try to staff evenly, male and female. But you're gonna find that there are certain people, there are certain donors. Gender does make a difference. And so you really got to have, you know, both guys and gals on your team. It's real important that you try to hire and staff that way. You know, and that is a trend that is that I think you would see across the whole industry. We have more female fundraising professionals doing major gift work today than 4 or 5 years ago. It's pretty good.
I would agree with you. I've seen that quite a bit lately. I want to ask you a question about boards. So kind of playing on the topic of, you know, expectation setting and, you know, setting up a major gift officer for success. One of the things that I feel like I've experienced, I'll caveat that by saying I've never asked the question directly, but we both spent enough time doing direct response fundraising that we know every, you know, 30 to 90 days you get a report. And once you've sent something out, 90 days later, you've got money to show for it, right? I feel like a lot of boards have gotten hooked on that cycle, and that's how they measure new major gift officers as well. And that seems, in my mind, to really set a lot of people up for failure if those donors haven't been cultivated before, or simply giving the gift officer time to sort of get themselves set up, get their feet under them, and launch into, you know, successful work. React to that. Am I crazy?
No, I mean, that was the first thing I had to do with our board, and it really took 2 or 3 meetings for them to get it.
Okay.
Is the activity metrics, focusing on the activity. You know, how many visits, how many proposals, how many outbound contacts, you know, getting them understanding that's the priority. If you increase that, the money will follow. You know, my first year, you know, we increased giving, not 100%, but it was probably 60%. And it happened primarily just because we met with people we had never met with before. We went from, you know, 300 meetings to 1,047 meetings.
Wow.
And so a lot of people increased their giving just because we took the time to come see them. In the second year, we increased giving because we were very intentional about the number of asks that we made. Okay. And, you know, we went from about 400 asks to, you know, close to 1,000. And so, you know, but those kind of metrics produce, if you measure activity and you teach your board the importance of activity, they know the money's going to follow. And I promise you it will. If you just put financial numbers in front of a board with them not having an understanding of how you get there, it can be really bad. You know, the board needs to understand how philanthropy works. And sometimes if you don't take the time to educate them on the activity metrics, they think they know philanthropy, but they're clueless. And it's really our job to help them understand what the day-to-day is really like. There's lots of ways to do that. You know, I try to, you know, have our board, and they're very, they've been very helpful in this regard with referrals, especially if I, you know, I have, and sometimes we, you know, we make sure that we know the backgrounds of each of our board members. And if we're meeting with somebody who's also a CFO at another place, or also an engineer at another place, or whatever the background is, we have a green light to reach out to that board member and see if they want to join us for lunch. And involving them in the day-to-day contact, you know, is a real important thing. Not every board member is good in front of donors, and I'm not saying they are. However, it's healthy for every board member to have some donor contact every year, and it helps them understand the process. And it helps you in getting the support you need. And so, again, the contact metrics are important, not just for your major gift officers, but your board should have an understanding of how philanthropy really works.
That's great. Thank you. So you were just before we started recording, you were telling me about one of your more recent trips to visit donors. And you've been, I think, probably in almost every state in the country in the last couple of years. Maybe you've been in all 50 talking to donors and
I'm just looking at this week. I've been everywhere but West Virginia. And I can't tell you
it's
why.
It's always next month, man.
But I can't tell you why. I think it has to do with our list acquisition strategy or something.
Okay. So here's my question about that. You're meeting with donors who oftentimes have incredible wealth and capacity. I'd love, and I think our listeners would love to know, from your experience with those donors, and you've probably, have you met with hundreds, a thousand? How many folks in the last couple of years?
Oh, I've met with 127 people in the last 18 months.
Okay.
And so, and every member of our team, we kind of have a goal. If you look at the industry, since most nonprofits of the 2 million in the United States mm-hmm. are regional, they'll tell you that the average major gift officer does between a dozen, 12, and 15 meetings or meaningful contacts a month. Now, if you're managing a multi-state region, like most of our, we call them regional managers, do, you know, it's going to be less than that. And we kind of manage to 10 visits a month.
Okay.
So most of my team will travel 2 weeks a month, and they'll knock out, you know, 4 or 5 visits each trip.
So I think, you know, one of the things I've been hearing a lot lately is concern and maybe just curiosity about what the quote unquote wealthy major donors are feeling about the state of the economy, the state of the nation, given, you know, everything that's going on politically, what feels like a complete disconnect of populations in the country. I'm curious to know, from your perspective and what you've been hearing, what's on the mind of the average major gift donor that you're talking to? Is there a fear about the economy? Do they feel like things are going well and their giving commitments are still what they should be? Or are people hiding, you know, hoarding money back, holding dollars and putting it on the sidelines? What's happening out there?
Well, I mean, we saw two things. The first was at the end of 2017, there was a big spike in giving.
Okay.
And that's because everybody... of course, at the time, it was because you had Roy Jones and all these great major gift officers out there doing their job, right?
Yep.
But the real deal was, looking back in retrospect, you know, they knew that tax changes were coming. No one knew exactly what that was going to be. And so they wanted to get their gift in before those changes came upon us. And that being the case, it really did impact us financially first quarter. We were down. But it's because people had anteed up at year end in a pretty dramatic way. My second quarter, it started to rebound. And now in third quarter, we are way ahead of last year. And from folks I've been talking to in the industry, other nonprofits, you're seeing very similar trends.
Okay.
You know, a big spike at 17. They're starting to see now all the changes that they implemented, you know, with the $12,000 cap. It is, and they think it probably will impact some middle donor giving.
Okay.
But major donors, they're going to continue to itemize like they always have. They're going to be way over that.
What I hear you saying is, we as gift officers shouldn't be fearful. We shouldn't be afraid to be making asks and engaging these donors, because they don't seem to be afraid.
No, and you know, even if they don't like the president. I meet people, some do and some don't.
Sure.
You know, I just listen, you know, but they believe that the economy is starting to trend the right direction.
Okay.
And so we're going to, you know, again, as that starts to set in, you know, provided something wacky doesn't happen, that really is going to help the entire nonprofit sector. And so, you know, I'm very confident as we move into third quarter and conclude the year, that this is going to be a strong one for the industry. I won't say it's you're going to see the strongest bump, but you're going to see a big uptick.
Awesome. That's good. That's a good prediction. From your lips to God's ears. We're just about out of time here. I want to ask you one more question, and that is, what's the best piece of fundraising advice you ever got, and who'd you get it from?
Well, probably the provost of Liberty University. And, you know, when you walked into his office, there was a sign above the door that said, "Show me the numbers." Nothing else mattered. Conceptually, that's where I learned to stop this weekly report goofiness, you know, to put the metrics, put the activity in the database, and the math proves itself. And, you know, I never thought I'd be in the math business, never thought. And we really are. And so, you know, it is about monitoring the activity. It is about staying in front of the people that we are called to, and I truly believe this, to minister to. I don't want to preach, but, you know, I used to say this when I was working with the Bush presidential campaign. Our job is to minister, to care for these donors. And if you go into it with that attitude, with that heart, that you're there to serve them, that you're not there to serve the charity, it changes everything. And, you know, that's the thing that, that, you know, our industry really needs to get a handle on. Whether you've got great sales skills or whether you're a good talker or just have a good work ethic, if you go into it with the attitude that there, we are there to serve the donor, the thing I know is that when that happens, the donors always, 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 money always follows ministry. And so if you care for the donor, they will invest in what you're doing.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thanks so much for sharing your insights and experience with us today. Again, this is Andrew Olson with Roy Jones, VP of Development at Mercy Ships, and we are the co-hosts of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast. Roy, how can people get in touch with you if they want to get in touch with you?
The best thing is just you can go to the website, royjones.org, and you can find out, reach me that way, phone numbers, all that kind of stuff. But royjones.org, Roy Jones Jr., the boxer, finally gave up .org about a year ago. I didn't have to fight him for it. And so now that's the best way to get me.
All right. Thanks so much, Roy. And folks, tune in next month for the next edition of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast. Thanks a lot, everyone.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Rainmaker Fundraising Podcast, brought to you exclusively by Newport One. Newport One can make a difference in your fundraising so that you can change the world. You can always reach us at podcast@newportone.com. Please take a moment to rate this episode on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. When you rate this episode, it will help more nonprofit leaders just like you to help find us and get the information that they need to raise more funds for their organization. Thanks again for listening today.